From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM later on tonight. Those Friday night and the Saturday morning open lines, here's what's happening. Wow, that's all I can say. Highly disruptive cyber attacks snarled web traffic on the East Coast Friday, shutting down access to some of the web's most popular sites, frustrating users. A slew of major sites, including Twitter, Netflix, Spotify, Reddit, were affected by what was described as several distributed denial-of-service attacks on the internet services company Dyn. Let's check in with the expert on the internet, Lauren Weinstein. Lauren, what do we know so far about this one?
Well, there's a lot of rumors going around, and there have already been some claims of responsibility. As you said, this was a rather large distributed denial-of-service attack. Unfortunately, these have become basically a business. It's a commodity now. You can actually go out on the dark net and buy these. I mean, 1,000 bots might be $50 for 3 hours, or 5,000 bots for an hour for $500. It's just something. It doesn't take technical skill to set this up anymore, because you can just buy them. There's a group called New World Hackers that has taken responsibility for this, and they're saying they were just doing this as a test. They wanted to highlight security vulnerabilities. They say they've actually done denial-of-service attacks on Islamic State. They're denying that this had anything to do with WikiLeaks. There have been stories going around today that this was WikiLeaks-related, a response to Julian Assange's internet being cut off. That's being denied. But the reality is, we don't really know, because these are so easy to do now, and they can be so effective so easily and so cheaply. In this case, because they attacked, as you said, they attacked Dyn. Dyn provides managed DNS services. That's why those other large companies were involved. Plus, all that denial of service traffic flowing toward Dyn likely caused ripple effects of traffic problems that have more broadly affected people on the internet that weren't the targets. They were basically collateral damage.
Any chance that this was done as a prelude test to shutting down or screwing around with our election results on November 8th?
It doesn't. It could well have been a test of a different sort, just to see how powerful denial of service attacks could be. But the good news is that our election system per se, all the local voting that's done, the local voting machines, the county tabulations and all of that, basically doesn't depend on the internet at all, certainly not in the context of attacks like this. So that doesn't seem likely. On the other hand, you have to assume that with the election coming up close, coming up so soon now, this is the sort of thing that attracts attention. You do it near an election and it gets attention. So even if you couldn't actually impact the election this way, it's sort of leveraging the election for publicity purposes.
Remember, Lauren, there are no coincidences.
Well, you know, the really scary part here is that this is the fundamental fragility of the domain name system, and the ease with which denial of service attacks can now be instigated is a really, really big deal, and there really are no clear-cut, broad solutions, technical solutions for dealing with it. And we're seeing these situations, and they usually, you know, kind of burn out after a few hours or a day or something. But we really do have to get a handle on this, and it's possible it'll require a major redesign of parts of the internet to do it properly.
You got it. Lauren, thank you so much. China and the Philippines could begin exploiting long untapped energy reserves in the South China Sea, according to reports coming out of this week's meeting between Filipino President Rodrigo Duterte and the high-ranking Chinese officials, including a Thursday sit-down with the Chinese president in Beijing. How soon that might happen remains unclear. However, the Philippine president cautioned reporters that he has not been empowered yet by his Congress to finalize any energy exploration deal with his Chinese counterparts. Just two diet drinks a day, could double the risk of diabetes, according to a study. Research by an institute says 2,800 adults found that those who consumed at least two 200 milliliter servings of soft drinks daily were 2.5 times as likely to suffer from a form of type 2 diabetes. While it's believed that deadly blasts of air that can flip over ships and bring planes crashing into the ocean could be behind the vanishing of at least 75 planes and hundreds of ships in the Bermuda Triangle. Amazing story. They say the mystery behind the Bermuda Triangle may have finally been cracked. The 500,000 kilometer square mile stretch in the North Atlantic Ocean has been blamed for the disappearance of at least 75 planes and hundreds of ships over the centuries. But scientists claim the truth behind the deadly triangle is all down to hexagonal clouds that create terrifying 170-mile-per-hour winds. They call them air bombs. It is believed that these deadly blasts of air can flip over ships and bring planes crashing into the ocean. How about that? Story we reported yesterday, experts believing now that the mysterious aluminum object dating back 250,000 years could indeed be part of an ancient UFO. What an amazing story. It's up there at coasttocoastam.com. Just search for it. And, of course, what's the update on UFOs this week? Let's check in with Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. Peter, what do you got for us?
Well, good evening, George, and I heard that report about that aluminum object last night. That's a fascinating story. I'm going to go up to the Coast website and take a look at it here in a moment. But boy, what a week it's been. Really, really interesting. A lot of good reports. I'm beginning to think that all these appearances on Coast have had a beneficial effect because I'm getting a lot of past sighting reports from Coast listeners. And I'd like to, just before I get into more recent sightings, briefly summarize five very, very interesting reports that I've received over the last week. Number one, Roswell, New Mexico, February 51. A woman writes that as a young girl, she was in Roswell and saw a distinct saucer. She alludes to a camera. I don't think she got a photograph, but I'm going to get back to her and see if we can get it. Second report, very interesting. I made the Seattle Times this last Sunday, interestingly, not about UFOs, but about politics. And it caused a gentleman, I believe, to submit a report that of a sighting he had while he was hiking on the Wonderland Trail at Mount Rainier, not far from Seattle, where the UFO phenomenon started, of course, with the Kenneth Arnold sighting back in July or June of 47. But two gentlemen walking on the Wonderland Trail, and they were camped about 11 o'clock at night, saw a very strange light moving across the sky. At first they thought it was a satellite, of course, but then it did a sudden, abrupt 90-degree turn. Third sighting from Fort Campbell, Kentucky. Young woman was a chief warrant officer, too. She was a pilot in command of a Chinook CH-47 helicopter. She and her wingman were hovered over the airport at Fort Campbell, saw a huge object. They got on the radio, called the tower, and the tower said that they'd been watching it, too. Anybody who's interested in that can find it posted to our website. A report from Fort Benning, Georgia. This is really interesting, George. A platoon was on a night training mission. They split into two for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
One group came back. They were babbling about having been chased or having seen a metallic-looking sphere that was giving off some metallic buzzing sound. They returned to the main group, and before anybody knew it, here comes this thing. The whole, I gather it was a platoon-sized unit, saw this object, and it came back a third time. Very interesting report. And more recently, gentleman I just talked with tonight, a senior pilot now for the last 16 years, was in Richland, Oregon, July 23rd of this year. He's an airline captain. He's an astronomer of 30 years tenure. He's also an official meteorologist, so an excellent, excellent witness. Saw, together with other witnesses, a very dramatic flashing light that was jumping all over the sky. He writes about it quite extensively, said he's never seen anything like it in his 30 years of astronomy work. But more recently, in fact, specifically this past Saturday, in Valle Vista, California, out near Hemet, east side of Los Angeles, gentleman was outside watering his grass, looked up, saw a helicopter, and he tracked it for a few seconds, I guess. Then he saw a cluster of five disks. Very, very interesting report, and I commend that to the attention of the Coast listeners. Last two reports briefly. Ypsilanti, Michigan, this morning, young mother was driving her kids to school, and her daughter said, "What's that, Mommy?" She looked up, and they saw a triangular craft that suddenly darted at their car.
Wow.
And then just disappeared from sight. Very interesting report. And finally, today, this afternoon, at 1:49 p.m., La Puente, California, gentlemen saw a very interesting disc-shaped craft. Goes into great detail in his report. I recommend that people take a look at it. And all of these reports are posted to UFOCenter.com.
Super. Peter, thanks. Have yourself a great weekend, and we shall talk to you soon. Up next, Monsters Among Us. Stand by for Linda Godfrey on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. What a night for you tonight. Researcher Linda Godfrey back on Coast to Coast. She's investigated Wolfman, Bigfoot, and other strange creatures over 24 years plus. Linda is the author of a number of published books, including Monsters Among Us, an exploration of otherworldly Bigfoots, Wolfmen, portals, phantoms, and odd phenomena. What a great title, Linda. Welcome back.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me back.
Well, you know, as we get close to Halloween, these stories really are great, aren't they?
They kind of resonate, I think, and I sort of prefer them to the evil clowns.
Hate evil clowns. What's going on with these clowns, anyways? What's happening?
Well, I think that there's a lot of wannabe stuff going on. You know, maybe a few people who started it, and I've actually had people corresponding to me who've had, there's a name for it, for fear of evil clowns, who have had this syndrome for years, and now it's kind of like their worst fears are coming true because there are evil clowns everywhere.
You know, Linda, I've been talking for years that I just don't like clowns, and I don't want anything to do with them. Tell me it wasn't me responsible for all these evil clowns all over the place.
No, I think there are clown forces far beyond us. But, you know, I live very close to where the National Clown Museum originated in Delavan, Wisconsin. And so I've been very used to clowns, and none of them looked really evil to me, but the ones out there now, maybe it's the wonderful proliferation of very realistic-looking Halloween masks that I have a feeling that even may play into it in some areas.
By the way, I've never had, over the years I've been talking about clowns and not liking them, I've never had one clown call me during open lines telling me why they are or are not clowns. It's interesting.
Ah. But they may have been sitting there in clown makeup saying something else, and you never would have known.
Well, that's true. That's true. Well, let's get into some of your work, Monsters Among Us. Tell me about that.
Well, this was a book that came about because I realized that over the past several, maybe even 4 or 5 years, I seemed to be getting more reports in which it was obvious there were connections to other things, things like unknown lights, unexplainable lights, UFOs, weird zones of deadness or quietness or something called the odds factors, strange mists and cloudy formations going with things, structures that looked like descriptions of portals, even classic descriptions of portals. And I thought it might be very interesting to find out whether all the creatures that I've been studying, the Bigfoot, the upright canines, even the great birds, if they were in any way connected with these things. Because, you know, I keep thinking back to Kiel's work about the window areas where he noticed that where there's a flap of one thing, other things are coming out, much like at his Point Pleasant study where the Mothman was reported. But at the same time, there were hundreds of UFOs and men in blacks and other sorts of things being reported in the same area.
Well, so, let's go ahead.
I'm sorry. So that's just what I was looking to do, was see if there were connections, and indeed there were many.
Let's talk about these UFOs. You just had Peter Davenport on from the National UFO Reporting Center, and the story right before that. is they found a 250,000-year-old, what they think is a piece of aluminum, but it's made, it's sculptured, it's a, looks like a working part of something, and they say that could have come from a UFO, and it's an amazing story. You've looked at UFOs, and they have been reports that UFOs are in the area during, like, sightings of Bigfoot and creatures like that. Does that make you think that these creatures are coming from these craft?
Well, it's one possibility. Another possibility is that the craft and the Bigfoot are both coming from the same place, maybe not together, but from the same area. It's kind of like everything escapes at the same time. Or I'm sometimes wondering, I just had this thought recently, when I study these creature reports, I usually try to map them out, go and see what is geologically and geographically in the landscape where they appear. And I thought, well, what if these lights and these UFOs and these odd mists and things are actually part of the same landscape from wherever these creatures originated, and we're seeing reflections of that other world accompanying them.
Now, with these sightings, though, that they see, I mean, how bona fide are they, these UFO sightings?
Well, it varies, you know, from place to place, and it's not always the witness that is aware of the UFO sightings. For instance, I have a story of a really kind of amazing Bigfoot encounter in Chicago itself, just about a mile east of O'Hare Airport along the Des Plaines Wildlife Sanctuary. And
what happened?
The thing is, the gentleman who experienced this, and I mean, I can go more into the encounter if you like.
Yeah, I'd love to hear it. Go ahead.
Yeah, and I'll just say quickly before I start that, he had no idea that there was any kind of a UFO sighting. I found that by taking his approximate date and digging into online files.
Was this the donut-shaped UFO sighting over O'Hare Airport?
No, I don't think so. This was two young men who saw it from their backyard.
Ah, okay. Yeah, that's different.
Event occurred, and it was flying low over power lines as if sucking up power. And they had a very good look at it, and quite a long look at it. So I thought that was very strong. But what this was in proximity to was happened several decades ago. It was reported to me by a former high school math teacher from Chicago, just very solid fellow.
Yeah.
You know, talk about bona fide witnesses. He would be it. And he was riding his new bike and along the bike path on the Des Plaines River, right where I had described earlier. And he decided to stop. It was very early in the morning, and watched the sunrise. So he kind of parked his bike and sat down amongst some tall plants and was just looking across the river at this peaceful scene, when all of a sudden this small group of very large brown-furred creatures appeared on the other side of the river. Now, that there's not a great deal of width, and it's pretty shallow, you know, so it's not like he was really protected by anything. And he's sitting there, extremely startled, not knowing what to do, and he's watching this one come forward. He realized that they look like Bigfoot, and this one just kind of leisurely reached up, pulled out a vine from the tree, and all of a sudden, to his horror, he realized that he was sitting in ragweed. It was that time of year, mm-hmm. and he had to cough and sneeze. And immediately, the Bigfoot came into the water, and while it was out of sight, he decided he had better move quickly. And so he went to another, pushed his bike as quietly and quickly as he could, hoping to get out of its sight of view, only to watch its surface right in front of where he had just been sitting. And he said it was picking up these flat river rocks off the bottom of the river and heaving them over its head at his exact former sitting position.
Huh.
So that was terrifying. And he said it had swum across, evidently, and the hair was all wet so that he could see one of its ears, where the hair was kind of wet back from the face, which is something I haven't heard people describe. And he said it looked rather like a human ear. It was, you know, kind of small and flat against the head, but it was pointed.
Hold on, Linda. We're going to take a break, come back and have you finish that story, and we'll talk more about monsters among us. With our special guest tonight, Linda Godfrey. Later on tonight, we'll take phone calls with Linda. You can share some of your stories as well as we talk about her work, Monsters Among Us. And welcome back, Linda Godfrey, with us as we're talking about her latest work, Monsters Among Us. Let's get back to that Bigfoot story, if you want, Linda, and let you finish it up.
Yeah, I'm just coming to the best part of it. When the creature realized that the young man wasn't sitting anymore, sitting where he had been, because the young man had to sneeze again, he quickly turned around and started heading straight for him. The other two or three that he'd seen on the other side of the river were, he said, were kind of jumping and making grunts and noises and howls as if he didn't know if they were, that was directed at him or if they were trying to get the other one, which I'm assuming was probably like an older juvenile, back to them, like, are you crazy? You're interacting with a human. Stop it. But it chased him on the bike path all the way back to the parking lot, or almost to it. And he said by the time they were close to the parking lot, he had still had the river on one side, the woods on the other, and he called out for God to save him. I think he said, he yelled, "Help me, Jesus." And then all of a sudden, it was not pounding after him anymore. He doesn't know. He actually thought it probably jumped into the woods, but he couldn't be sure because he didn't see it. He didn't hear any splashing sound, but it was just gone. And I met him there in researching this book, and we walked those paths and everything, and it was kind of incredible, but you could see exactly where everything was that he had described and checked out, and then to find that there was a UFO sighting very close by during that same time period was very interesting.
Many people think that these creatures and or UFOs may be coming from within this planet, like the, you know, a center somewhere in this planet for the UFOs. In terms of Bigfoot, I'm pretty well convinced, Linda, that it's a creature indigenous to this planet. I don't think it's dimensional, but you mentioned portals in the title of your book, Monsters Among Us. So explain that.
Right. Well, they, you know, I hear it so often from First Nation people that they believe that the upright canines and the Bigfoots are partly interdimensional, partly without, they will call it a spirit creature, and that they originated in a spirit world that's somehow very closely related to ours, so that they can go back and forth, and that what it kind of boils down to is that they exist here on sort of a sliding scale of reality. In other words, they're totally flesh and blood most of the time when they're here. And I mean, I've had some personal encounters and incidents, and they seemed like completely flesh and blood creatures to me, you know, doing things like ripping big things off of trees. But then other people have had experiences where the creatures are either seen to vanish right in front of them, or they see the footprints that go along for a certain way and then just stop and are gone. I had a gentleman who's quite a scholar from Argentina wrote me about some of these sorts of incidents, and he was giving me examples of both the Bigfoot and then something they call, I think, an Ukumari, if I have it correctly, if I'm pronouncing it right, that's more of a bear-like type creature. And he said they're all this way. They come from another sort of reality, but when they're here, they're completely flesh and blood. They can eat. They need to eat. That's why you see them chasing deer, catching chickens and people's pets, that kind of thing, and seem to reproduce here, but they can go back where they want to when they need to.
Well, now these portals, because David Paulides writes books on missing people, and part of the theory, I think, is that these people may stumble into some kind of portal and they merely disappear and they're gone. They're gone.
Yeah.
Is that possible?
Well, his books are fascinating.
Oh, my God, yeah, they're scary.
They are. And I think everybody's been wishing that he would actually set forth what he thinks, you know, since he's...
He holds back. He doesn't like to give us a conclusion there.
The primary research, but I think it's possible in some cases, but, you know, a lot of the ones that he describes are just, they're not running into something or running into an isolated area. They're just sort of plucked off the path. And yet, I do have one account in my book that tells about a man who was up in an area of Canada where he saw this kind of weird, weird-looking area, and he walked into it and found himself suddenly in literally another world. There were beings. He was walking like through some sort of metal-like patch of ground, and there were these beings that looked humanoid. They were dressed in robes, and they were floating, and they kind of came toward him. He was able to actually get out from whatever this was and, you know, never went back in it. So I don't know. It's just impossible to say. It's something that could occur, I guess, if these people are disappearing into portals. But I think it's interesting that Mr. Pleiades also notes no one who is wearing a GPS unit of some sort and a firearm has ever been taken to.
Right. That's strange, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so you'd wonder, you wouldn't think that if it was just a portal waiting there for anybody to fall into it, that it would discriminate. So, yeah, it's an interesting theory, but they're all mostly theories, and even though, you know, our leading-edge scientists have now created equations that predict and almost demand the existence of multiple worlds with openings between them, and they've even, I think, proven or demonstrated on a subatomic level that they can interact with, or some other world could interact with ours. We still don't know what those worlds would be like, or whether we could survive in them, or how alike or different things that come out of them are from us.
Linda, have you ever seen a UFO?
I have.
Tell me that story. What happened? Where were you?
Well, and this is not a nuts and bolts type UFO. It was a flying sphere. It happened in a field in Wisconsin that I'd been assisting the property owner with for several years, because he started out finding strange animal mutilations in the field, and began experimenting by laying deer carcasses in a certain area. And I think he was about on deer carcass number 17. This was within the past year. And he and a colleague and I decided to stake out the area. And I suggested that we go at night and just park very inobtrusively again across the field from the carcass where it was laid.
Okay, sure.
So we're sitting in this car, and we're watching lights on a nearby airplane's path where there were lots of craft going out that evening. And all of a sudden, I said, "Hey, guys, that one is not an airplane," because it was moving back and forth, not just oscillating in a little bit, but it was widely moving back and forth. It had departed and deviated from that airline's lane. And as soon as I said that, and we all focused our attention upon it, which may be a key factor, it began to head across the field toward us. And it wasn't going super fast. It was taking its time. It took a couple of minutes for it to get to us. And we're the whole time examining it and visually, and trying to figure out what it is, if it's a helicopter or a plane. And finally, it stopped about 30 feet from the car, 30 feet above ground, and appeared to be about the size of a basketball. It was a spherical white thing. And just as I'm pulling up my camera to take pictures, and actually I was taking a video, I had it all set, my friend Sanjay Singhal, who was along with the property owner and I, grabbed a flashlight and just immediately flashed it on this sphere. And we all had the distinct impression that it was surprised, because it just like hesitated a moment, like, "Oh, when did you do that? For that was just our impression.
Yeah.
And then it just sort of weirdly imploded, or it's very hard to describe what it did. It's like it turned itself off, but not instantly. There was sort of an afterglow for a second, and then it was gone, just completely gone. And we all yelled or screamed something, because what we had just seen was impossible with, you know, the modern physics that we'd been taught, in my case, a little bit that I knew. But one of these people was a math and physics teacher, another one of these math teachers from Chicago, but this man also was an expert in physics. And it was an unidentified flying object, you know, so it fills that bill. But it wasn't quite like, you know, the football field-sized triangles or, you know, the nuts and bolts type that people do sometimes see.
Years ago, Linda, people used to report seeing occupants in the craft. We don't hear much of that anymore. I remember a case in New Guinea where a group of missionaries would see these craft with beings in there looking down on them.
Yes, I've interviewed somebody who has seen that. He was in the Navy and was stationed in the Philippines, and they had cameras on their guns that they would search around using the gun scopes, and then when they'd see these things, they would take photos of them. And he said, looking through the scopes one day, so they had a pretty good view of it, he saw what looked sort of like portholes and beings or heads or something like that moving around inside. And he said whenever that occurred, if they actually got pictures, someone from the government would arrive the next day and confiscate everything that was in all the gunnery cameras.
That would be something to see, that. Occupants
in
the craft. I mean, have they, in terms of anybody, because you've talked a little bit about this, animals behind the craft, controlling the craft, animals or animal-looking creatures.
Yeah, one of the most famous of those was in Wisconsin. It was a farmer whose last name was Bozak, and he was driving home at night from, I think it was a farmer's grange meeting, and this craft, this round thing, was sitting in the middle of the road between him and the last mile or so to his house. And he said the top part of it was like covered with glass or some sort of transparent substance, and there was a completely furred creature in there with, you know, long brown fur. He said its head reminded him of the shape of a cow head, and it had both of its arms up in the air almost as if it were surrendering or pleading for help or something like that. And he was just afraid of it and kept on going and went home. And the next day he did find circular marks out in the driveway.
But, oh, my gosh.
Frederick Bozak, his name was.
Yeah. Spook lights, what are they exactly, and how do they compare to UFOs?
Well, spook lights can have a lot of different origins, according to, of course, the most famous one is marsh gas or swamp gas.
Poor J. Allen Hynek.
Yes, yes. They're generally perceived to be lights floating around in wooded areas, near the ground, or often in swampy areas. And their origin, will-o'-the-wisps, sometimes people call them, is still not really super well known or understood by scientists. So explaining one unknown phenomenon with another has never seemed like a really satisfactory thing from my point of view. But what I write about in this book are some things that go a little beyond that. They are mists, not just vaporous things floating all over and not these tiny little lights zipping around, but mists that travel around and retain a shape, often in a column type of shape or kind of a square. And I had one man who's a sheriff's deputy who was sitting near Cattail Marsh doing his reports one evening. It was near sundown, and he looked out on the marsh, and there was this shape of green mist proceeding across the marsh, heading straight for him and his squad car. And, you know, he just was kind of fascinated and was watching it. And It came right up to his car, rolled over his car, and at that moment shut down every electronic device that he had in his squad car, the lights, the radio, the computer that he had on at the time. And then it turned, it made an angular turn, and went up a path into a woods that is happens to be known, although he didn't know it at the time, for Bigfoot sightings. And it's also known locally to have some kind, there's a local legend that it has a portal in that woods, and it went up that way. And he didn't realize it at the time until it was only later after he thought it over and realized that he lost about 45 minutes of time during that little episode, too. It didn't seem apparent. He thought it was just a matter of minutes, but 45 minutes were gone.
Now, the Skinwalker Ranch in Utah, of course, which our colleague George Knapp and Colm Kelleher have written a book about, mm-hmm. Is another strange, bizarre situation, is it not?
It is. It's super, super strange, super bizarre. And I did write briefly about it in this book because it reminded me so much of this hayfield property where we saw the UFO. Because it had this wide variety. The one in Utah was well known for large canines, for what people called orange structures that appeared to be portals of some kind, because they would show up and then something dark would come out and run away from it. There were strange lights, cattle mutilations, just all sorts of horrendous things that forced this ranch family that had planned to raise prize cattle on the ranch to sell it to a group of scientists. Richard Bigelow, I believe, was the man who purchased it.
He did buy it, 480 acres.
Yes, exactly. And then they were performing experiments with trained scientists with the top cutting-edge monitoring equipment, photographic equipment, you name it. They had every tool of the trade, and yet they weren't able to come up with anything really concrete to show for it. And in fact, the trail cameras would fail just as often as they failed us out on the hayfield here in Wisconsin. And yet the hayfield in Wisconsin also had weird mutilations. I could describe several different kinds to you. Five-toed large canine prints. Another weird kind of print that looked like a U-shape that was filled in, that would go down very deeply into the soil. Very strange lights, UFOs, you name it, they were all out there. It was kind of like a mini Skinwalker Ranch.
What do you think's going on?
Just the time when you think you've answered one question, 10 more will pop up. It seems like it is one of those John Keel window areas. And being where it is, I did do some research. The only thing I could find to explain it was that it's very close to the intersection of two very ancient Native American trails that led around to all kinds of summer camps in this area of southeastern Wisconsin. And the cardinal directions, north, south, east, west, are represented almost exactly by these old trails, and they're now highways. And then there are also diagonal trails that lead through the same exact intersection point. And that is exactly adjacent to the land that I'm talking about. Now, when I went around and looked at the different meanings of medicine wheels and what they could represent, I did find several references in First Nation literature that claimed the center of a geologically formed medicine wheel could be a vortex.
We're coming back to talk more about some of these strange stories, Linda, and we'll take some phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM.